Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, June 14. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today we're expecting another sunny day. Winds will be from the north at 5 to 15 miles per hour in Cedar Rapids. We'll see a high of 88 in Iowa City, falling to a low tonight of 60 in Cedar Rapids, 61 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 8:44 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow morning at 5:31 a.m. for a total daylight period of 15 hours and 13 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette. From Iowa, Afghan fights deadly deportation. This is a story by Aaron Murphy of the Gazette staff. The terrorists rode on motorcycles to the home in Afghanistan. They wore masks and carried guns. They came upon a little boy, grabbed him by the neck, and demanded he bring them bread. If he didn't, they would harm him and his family, they said. The little boy was 9 years old. He'd never seen a gun before, and he was scared. He did as they asked. Now, many years later, that interaction could prove to be a death sentence for Zalmay Niazi, an Iowa Falls man, and the little boy in that story who is fighting an immigration effort to return him to Afghanistan. A decade after that day, he brought that piece of bread, a piece no bigger than a cell phone, to those terrorists. Niazi, who had learned English as a child, began working as an interpreter for U.S. military forces in Afghanistan. He did that for 3 years, from 2007 to 2009, putting his life in danger, both at work — he was wounded in multiple bombings — and at home, where Taliban forces threatened him and his family. The Taliban in 2008 made good on its threats, killing Niazi's uncle, he said. A few years later, Niazi's employer sent him to a work conference in Washington, D.C. Niazi made plans to not only attend the conference, but while in the United States, also apply for political asylum under a program created for former interpreters who aided U.S. military, like Niazi. Shortly after arriving in America, it became clear the Taliban knew of Niazi's travels, and the threats resumed. Niazi's parents warned him not to return home. They feared if he did, the Taliban would kill him. Niazi reached out to a family member already in the States, his cousin, Farid Ahmad, in Iowa Falls. Ahmad also had worked as an interpreter and immigrated to the United States through the same program to which Niazi hoped to apply. Niazi moved in with his cousin in 2015, and he has lived in Iowa Falls ever since. He applied for political asylum through the Special Immigrant Visa Program, although he did not hear about his case for years. Meanwhile, he made a life for himself in Iowa Falls. He worked myriad odd jobs, landscaping, construction, and others, to make money. While there were setbacks along the way, he continued to work, sometimes 12-hour days for 7 days a week, he said. Now, Niazi runs his own contracting company, Z Handyman Services, named after the nickname by which he has become known around Iowa Falls. He bought a home, which he has renovated. But just as life was getting comfortable for Niazi, he was dealt a crushing blow. In May, his application for asylum was denied by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The reason given? That interaction Niazi had as a 9-year-old boy with Taliban terrorists. Niazi served alongside U.S. troops in Afghanistan for 3 years during Operation Enduring Freedom. He was shot at, wounded, and had his life threatened repeatedly because of that work. And now the federal government that Niazi once assisted in the theater of war has told him he cannot stay here because, as a child under threat of death, he gave terrorists a piece of bread. "I'm very disappointed, to be honest with you," Niazi said last week during a phone interview from his home in Iowa Falls. "I thought I will be treated a little better by the government. I've been very, very disgusted by what I got and what I have went through over the last 6 years of my life." Niazi is scheduled for a hearing before an immigration judge on June 28 in Omaha. The Iowa Falls community has rallied around him, hoping to find a way for him to stay in the United States. Because if he is forced to return to Afghanistan, that is a death sentence, Niazi said. Keith Herting, a Des Moines lawyer who has been working with Niazi, said what constitutes support of terrorism in recent years has expanded and become more skewed. He points to a 2018 case in which a woman was denied asylum because after being captured and seeing her husband murdered by guerrillas in El Salvador, she was forced to cook and clean for the guerrillas. Providing those services, even under threat of death, was considered by the immigration court to be support of terrorists. Herting is concerned Niazi's case will suffer the same fate. I don't like putting odds on outcomes for my clients, but the case law is not positive for Zalmay, Herting wrote in an email. Certainly, we still have hope that we can get people interested enough in his story, that there may be positive change, but without some reform in the law, he's facing a very steep uphill climb. I am sure the court will be sympathetic to his story, but sympathy doesn't change the law, and the law in this area is fundamentally rotten. As Niazi said, that is the form of appreciation for what I've done for the country and what I am getting in return from it. Niazi made clear his frustration is with the U.S. government and its asylum laws, not with the people he has met here. He expressed a deep love of and gratitude for the Iowa Falls community. Iowa has been very great to me, and that's why I've stayed here. I have close family in other states, but I love Iowa Falls. I've been treated good, Niazi said. I'm overwhelmed with the support of the whole state, especially Iowa Falls. Niazi's story has been told before. It's been documented by his hometown paper, the Iowa Falls Times-Citizen, and in 2017 gained national attention after Niazi spoke at a town hall hosted by U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa. Niazi is trying to remain optimistic. Like the community that has embraced him, he is exhausting all options, hoping to find a way to remain in the country. He has to, because the alternative is dire. I guess I have to fight it, Niazi said. That's the only way that I can survive. Iowa's been very great to me, and that's why I've stayed here. I have close family in other states, but I love Iowa Falls. I am overwhelmed with the support of the whole state, especially Iowa Falls. Also from today's front page, local election officials quit over new laws. Iowa among states where administrators have left over frustration with new voting requirements. There is no shortage of job openings for local election officials in Michigan. It's the same in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin too. And an elections leader in Iowa earlier this spring retired early out of frustration. After facing threats and intimidation during the 2020 presidential election and its aftermath, and now the potential of new punishments in certain states, county officials who run elections are quitting or retiring early. The once quiet job of election administration has become a political minefield thanks to the baseless claims of widespread fraud that continue to be pushed by many in the Republican Party. These conspiracy theorists are in it for the long haul. They are in it to completely crumble our republic, and they're looking at these election administrator positions, said Democrat Bob Byram, clerk of Ingham County, Michigan. They're playing the long game. It's difficult to quantify exactly how many election officials across the country have left and why, since the departures are not generally tallied. Retirements are also common after presidential elections. But in places that do track such information, along with anecdotal accounts from county officials, it is clear that many have recently left because of the newfound partisan rancor around the jobs and the threats many local election workers faced leading up to the November election and afterward, as former President Donald Trump and his allies challenged the results. In Davenport, Democratic Scott County Auditor Roxana Moritz retired earlier than expected in April after 14 years on the job and just 5 months after being reelected. On her way out, she blasted local supervisors for a lack of support in last year's elections and cited Iowa's new elections law, which, among other things, threatens local election officials with jail time and fines. "I was going to retire anyway in December. This just cemented it," Moritz told the Quad City Times. "My office is walking on eggshells." The GOP-controlled Scott County Board of Supervisors appointed a Republican to replace her after local Democrats failed to gather enough signatures on a petition to call for a special election. In Pennsylvania, about a third of the county officials have left in the last year and a half, according to a spokesman for the state's County Commissioners Association, who cited heavy workloads and rampant misinformation related to voting among the reasons. "It was particularly challenging last year with all the misinformation and angst out there," said Lisa Schaefer, executive director of the County Commissioners Association of Pennsylvania, "and none of it was caused by county election officials." The executive director of a clerks association in Wisconsin said more than two dozen clerks have retired since the presidential election, and another 30 clerks or their deputies quit by the end of 2020. 13 have left since the beginning of this year. The local election jobs are being vacated as Trump's false claims of fraud persist within the GOP and provide a platform for his loyalists to launch campaigns to become top election officials in several swing states. In Georgia, U.S. Representative Jody Heiss, a Trump recruit who voted to overturn the presidential results in the U.S. House, is challenging Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a Republican who has been attacked by his own party for upholding President Joe Biden's victory. Arizona State Representative Mark Finchem, who was at the January 6 rally outside the Capitol and is a chief supporter of a partisan review of ballots in Maricopa County, is running for Secretary of State. Former Nevada lawmaker Jim Marchant, who has clung to the conspiracy theory that the election was stolen from Trump, is campaigning to replace Republican Secretary of State Barbara Sagavsky. She can't run again because of term limits. The exodus comes as Republicans in a number of states, including Iowa, pursue legislation that imposes new fines or criminal penalties on local election officials. Just last week, the Iowa Secretary of State's office issued two notices of technical violations against Moritz. She was accused, among other things, of falsifying working hours for poll workers to justify paying them more because the June 2020 primary, when the coronavirus pandemic made it difficult to recruit help. Moritz previously said she made a mistake and thought she had the authority, as she had money within her budget to do so. There is no fine associated with the technical infractions, as Moritz's actions took place before the changes to Iowa's election law. But under the new law, county election officials could face felony charges, including jail time and a fine of up to $10,000 for a technical infraction of the law or failure to follow guidance from the Secretary of State. Turning to today's opinion page, we have a guest column by Art Cullen, who is a syndicated columnist and editor of the Storm Lake Times in Northwest Iowa. He's author of the book Storm Lake: Change, Resilience, and Hope in America's Heartland. And he wrote this column today for the Washington Post. It's entitled, "We're Getting Fed Up with Hogs Fouling Our Nests." Ah, the sweet smell of money on a fine spring morning. That's what we used to say here in Iowa, the pork capital of the United States, where manure covers the black loam like dew. This month, science confirmed what our noses have been telling us for some time. We long have known that chemical fertilizer, anhydrous ammonia, and livestock manure from cattle, swine, and poultry have conspired to make Midwestern surface waters toxic with nitrate and phosphorus, which promote deadly blue-green algae from Toledo to Des Moines. It's suffocating the Gulf of Mexico, too. All sorts of maladies result from drinking the water from Lake Erie in northwestern Ohio to the Raccoon River in Iowa. Now comes a study led by researchers from the University of Minnesota, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, reporting that 15,900 deaths per year from air pollution can be attributed to people living around livestock. Northwest Iowa has the densest concentration of farm animals of any place in America, and the livestock industry keeps expanding. We are flooded in manure. We wear suspenders with our belts, applying enough anhydrous ammonia to yield 200 bushels of corn per acre, then throwing some chicken litter on top for insurance. So the Floyd River has nitrate levels 4 times greater than considered safe by the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Resentment over the pollution isn't partisan. I have buddies who voted for Donald Trump who will not eat a walleye caught in the Little Sioux River. They know what's in it. They bemoan the loss of habitat as every last acre of grass is plowed up for corn to feed our 24 million hogs, at least a third of which will be cut into pork for China. In fact, Smithfield Foods, a subsidiary of a giant Chinese conglomerate, is the leading pork producer in the world and has a major presence in Iowa. We in Northwest Iowa are paying the price for all that ammonia floating into the air from the hogs, from the particulates of manure suspended beneath our noses, and from the tillage that makes the sun glow pink from the dust it kicks up. Years ago, scientists demonstrated the threat of lung disease for pig barn workers. Most rural Midwesterners are well aware of higher incidences of asthma among school children, including those who live among Iowa's 56 million laying hens. The Minnesota study puts a number on the death toll. Of course, the livestock industry poo-poos it. 30 years ago, it claimed that the Raccoon River was so hot near Storm Lake because of the 9-hole golf course and lawns, until eye rolls retired that line. People who put up with it know better. In Ohio, a poll commissioned by the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago, conducted in April by Ann Selzer, reported that 93% of Northwestern Ohioans near Lake Erie said that clean water is their top issue, ranking above jobs or health care. 81% want more regulation on confined feeding operations. In other polls and surveys over the years, Selzer has found strong support in Iowa for clean water and remediation. In 2010, more than 60% of Iowa voters approved a constitutional amendment to devote a fraction of a cent sales tax to natural resource preservation. The legislature has refused to enact it. There is little in either state to hold back the expanding tide of air and water pollution from livestock owned by corporate feeders. Just enforcing the existing manure management plans or following Iowa State University fertilizer guidelines would be a good start, but nobody even knows where all those plans are anymore. Iowa's coordinator for confined livestock operations was laid off a few years ago. Fish kills are routine when manure pipelines burst into the Raccoon in Iowa or the Maumee River feeding Lake Erie. The operator gets a fine and then lives to fill his manure trucks while they chew up our gravel roads. Iowa has 24 million hogs pooping the equivalent of 83 million people. The land is saturated. The slurry has no place to go but into the air and water. Yet, more hog houses are being built up the Missouri River in South Dakota, where the soil types can't filter it. Farmers are none the better for it. There are half as many in my county as there were before livestock moved indoors. But a lot more people are demanding protein in their diets since registration is clearly off the table. Since regulation is clearly off the table, we can hope that world population trends down because the planet can't stand the abuse from yet more corn feeding more hogs, or that production of meat grown in a fermentation lab ramps up. They say it tastes like chicken. People think we've hit our limit, not big pork. The National Pork Producers Council is urging U.S. Secretary Tom Vilsack to speed up the slaughterhouse kill line. He refused, and appeals are likely. More hogs are on the way, and time is money. Smells like money, too, if it doesn't kill you. And we have two community letters today. The first one coming from Bob Watson of Decorah. His letter is entitled, Gazette Letter on Left's Agenda Was a Doozy. I see the Gazette followed up on the whining from the right-wingers about no right-wing letters making it into the pages of the paper and put in a doozy regarding Wake Up America to the Left's True Agenda, published on June 7. I can't remember a letter that I have read that contained more misinformed understanding of history, more historical inaccuracies, more wrong definitions, and more misplaced accusations. Of course, I don't do social media, so I may have been missing something. Did the Gazette do this just to show people that you need actual facts and a baseline understanding of acceptable definitions and history to write something that people will be interested in reading? Or just to placate the people who have decided that facts and historical perspective don't matter? That letter by Bob Watson of Decorah. And a letter from Les Deal of Cedar Rapids. This letter is entitled, Let Women Maintain the Right to Control Their Bodies. Abortion is about individual rights. Nature assigned the creation of life to women. All care for the unborn comes from the would-be mom. She makes the decisions regarding its health, its safety, and even if it gets to live. That is how individual rights work. The unborn is inside her body and dependent upon her to make it to birth. The rest of us need to trust in how she interprets that responsibility and respect how it turns out. It doesn't matter when life begins. What matters is that each woman controls everything inside her body, including a new life. The unborn has no rights. The rest of us must respect her wishes. We must trust her decisions with her body. Trust and respect is fundamental in order for individual rights to have merit anywhere. Abridging a woman's right over her body is a form of slavery, regardless if it is volunteer slavery or forced slavery. In either case, it is stripping her of freedom. Yes, many women willingly accept giving up control of their bodies to legislatures, religions, and others. Volunteer slavery. In this country, under this Constitution, every man and every woman's body is their own, not to be regulated by government, spouse, or anyone. Women and men, let's end this charade. It's time women have control of their lives and become owners of their own beings. Total control over your body is a foundation tenet to freedom and individual rights. This letter by Les Deal of Cedar Rapids. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, June 14, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Cedar Rapids, Donald Lee Odegaard, age 81, passed away peacefully at home on June 11 following a short illness. Visitation will be at noon on Wednesday, June 16, at the Stuart Baxter and Memorial Services at 1844 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids, followed by a brief service at 1 p.m. From Oxford, Jack D. Jessup, age 70, passed away on June 10 in Iowa City. Services celebrating Jack's life will be at 5 p.m. Wednesday, June 16, at the Oxford United Methodist Church. And from Cedar Rapids, Barbara Jean Ray, age 82, passed away peacefully on Friday, June 11, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. Celebration of life services will be noon, Tuesday, June 15, at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. A private family burial will be in Oakland Cemetery in Solon. A visitation will be from 10 a.m. until service time Tuesday, June 15, at the Brosh Chapel. From Independence, Joanne M. Wolfkuhl, age 81, died on Saturday, June 12, at the Prairie Hills Assisted Living Center in Independence. A Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, June 15, at the St. John's Catholic Church in Independence. Burial will be at St. John's Catholic Cemetery, also in Independence. A visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. Monday, June 14, at the Rife Family Center, Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. A rosary will be said at 3:45 p.m. on Monday. From Oxford, Ronald Harold Hummer, Jr., formerly of Oxford, passed away on January 1 after a short illness. A celebration of Ron's life will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Saturday, June 26, at the R.H. Hummer, Jr., Incorporated, offices located at 2141 P Avenue in Williamsburg. A private burial service will be in the Oxford Cemetery. From Harper's Ferry, Shirley K. Elliott, age 79, died on Friday, June 11, at the Veterans Memorial Hospital in Waukon. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, June 16, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Waukon. Burial will be at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Waukon. Friends may call from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon, where there will be a 3:30 p.m. scripture service. From Center Point, Willard James Horrock, age 88, passed away on Saturday, June 12, at his home surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Wednesday, June 16, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. A funeral service will follow at 1 p.m. Wednesday at the funeral home. Burial with military honors will follow at Center Point Cemetery. All guests are respectfully requested to wear a face mask and practice social distancing. From Hawkeye, Robert, also known as Bob H. Campbell, age 77, died unexpectedly Thursday, June 10, in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Funeral services will be held at 3 p.m. Tuesday, June 15, at the United Methodist Church in Hawkeye. Interment will follow at Hawkeye Cemetery with military rites, provided by Arnold Rogers Post 312, American Legion of Hawkeye. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, June 14, at the Becker and Son Funeral Home in Hawkeye, and for 1 hour preceding services at the church on Tuesday. A Masonic service on Monday at 7:30 p.m. at the funeral home, conducted by the Mason Lodge 69 of West Union. From Davenport, Francis, also known as Fran Margaret Denton, age 92, passed away on June 10 at Silvercrest of Friendship Manor. Services will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 15, at the Wirtz Funeral Home in Davenport, with visitation an hour prior to the service from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. at the funeral home. From Iowa City, Josephine Dunn Gibbs. Her celebration of life will be on June 18 at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City. The family will greet friends at 9 a.m. with a funeral mass beginning at 10 a.m. Burial will be in St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. From Iowa City, Berdina, also known as Bernie Wells Mulford, age 94, passed away on Saturday, February 27, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics with her family by her side. a time for family and friends to gather to celebrate Bernie's life, will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. Saturday, June 26, at the Elks Country Club at 637 Foster Road in Iowa City. Also from Iowa City, David Bruce Hackman, age 91, went home to be with his Savior on Friday, May 7. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. June 17 at Good News Bible Church in Iowa City, with fellowship to follow. A private burial will be held at Unity Cemetery in rural Iowa City. From Marion, Frank Gary O'Connell, age 87, passed away on Friday, June 11, at his home with his family by his side. A parish vigil will be held at 4 p.m. Monday, June 14, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, followed by a visitation from 4:30 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, June 15, at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery in Marion, with visitation 1 hour prior. Burial will follow at 3 p.m. at St. Patrick's Little Creek Cemetery in rural North English. And from Monticello, Garnett Helgens, age 81, died Thursday, June 10, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center following a brief illness. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, June 17, at the Getch Funeral Home in Monticello, where friends may call after 9:30 a.m. Interment will be in the Oakwood Cemetery in Monticello. From Guttenberg, William, also known as Bill Richard Lellafield, age 81, died Thursday, June 10, at the Guttenberg Municipal Hospital. Arrangements are being handled by the Toik Allen Funeral Home at 207 South 1st Street in Guttenberg. The family will receive friends from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, June 15, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Guttenberg. And from Topeka, Kansas, Josephine, also known as Josie N. Palumbo Callen, of Norman, Oklahoma, and formerly of Topeka, Kansas, passed away on June 10 at the Norman Regional Hospital in Norman, Oklahoma, after a brief illness. In celebration of her life, a rosary will be said at 9:30 a.m. Thursday, June 17, before the funeral mass at 10 a.m. at Christ the King Catholic Church at 5973 Southwest 25th Street in Topeka, Kansas. A graveside service will follow at Mount Calvary Cemetery at 801 Southwest Westchester Road in Topeka. And from Iowa City, Talbot A., also known as Bill Williams, age 76, formerly of rural Solon, died at his home surrounded by his family on Friday, March 19. A memorial service for friends and family will be held at a later date. And in other death notices, from Aurora, Kimberly Marie Gam, age 61, died Friday, June 11. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine is assisting the family. From Blairstown, Mardine J. Kim, age 81, died Saturday, June 12. The Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Orville Frank Walton, age 90, died Saturday, June 12. The Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Fayette, John C. Pleiss, age 95, died Saturday, June 12. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Arlington is assisting the family. From Marion, Viola Lohman, age 91, died Sunday, June 13. The Brass Chapel and the Epicenter in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From New Ulm, Anne Elizabeth Folkman, age 57, died Friday, June 11. The Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton is assisting the family. And from St. Olaf, Irma Rose Glau, age 94, died Friday, June 11. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Elkader is assisting the family. And from Tama, Genevieve, also known as Jean Wasiskuk, age 95, died Friday, June 11. The Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama, Toledo, is assisting the family. And from West Union, Edward Charles Schmidt, age 76, died Saturday, April 18. The Burnham Wood Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in West Union is assisting the family. Turning to today's sports page, we have a junior hockey article entitled NJ Devils GM Attends Tryouts as a Dad. This is by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette staff. He was not here this weekend as a National Hockey League general manager scouting young talent. Tom Fitzgerald attended Cedar Rapids Rough Riders tryout camp in the I'm on Ice Arena in a more important role and with a more important title. Much more important. I'm a dad, Fitzgerald said. The New Jersey Devils general manager traveled to town with his son, Brendan, who appears to have impressed enough to at least right now be part of the 2021-22 Riders. Brendan Fitzgerald is an 18-year-old defenseman who played prep school hockey in Massachusetts this past season. A University of New Hampshire commit and former draft pick of the USHL's Chicago Steel, Brendan was among a group of participants in Sunday's Top 40 game that met with Rough Riders coaches post-game, which always is a good sign. I just wanted to spend some quality time with Brendan that you don't normally get, Tom Fitzgerald said. I'm living in New Jersey and he's in Boston. This was a great weekend, though it started off horrible. Fitzgerald said he and his son had a canceled flight on their journey west, their luggage not showing up in Cedar Rapids initially. Brendan had some of his hockey sticks broken in transit, which set them on a scramble to find replacements. I just felt bad for him, Fitzgerald said. We figured it out, we handled it, got him some sticks. He started off the weekend well, I thought. It's a hard league, something that Eastern kids aren't exposed to because of geography. He looked really comfortable and confident, not really knowing what to expect. I thought the pace was really good. Mark Carlson did a really good job of making everyone feel welcomed and comfortable. It's a hard league, something that Eastern kids aren't exposed to because of geography, but he's looking forward to this, as are we. Fitzgerald and his wife have three other sons, two of whom play professionally. Ryan was drafted by the Boston Bruins and played this past season for Lehigh Valley of the American Hockey League, which is a Philadelphia Flyers affiliate. Casey Fitzgerald is a Buffalo Sabres draft pick who just finished his second full season in the AHL with Rochester. Tom Fitzgerald played three shy of 1,100 games in the NHL over parts of 19 seasons with the New York Islanders, Florida Panthers, Colorado Avalanche, Nashville Predators, Chicago Blackhawks, Toronto Maple Leafs, and the Bruins. His front office jobs have included being Director of Player Development and Assistant General Manager for the Pittsburgh Penguins. He went from Assistant General Manager to Interim General Manager of the Devils in January 2020. I looked around on the arena walls of all of the pictures of former players, and it was, oh, I didn't know he played here, Fitzgerald said. There have been some really good hockey players that have come through here. You see a lot of good hockey players coming out of the USHL. It's a longer path. It's not like the Canadian Hockey League where you get 2 years and then you have to make a decision on a kid. Colleges are getting players who are ready. That's important. The three-day tryout camp consisted of 119 hopefuls. Only two have ever played for the Rough Riders, goalies Nicholas Simo and Andrew Pechora. That's a sign coach and general manager Carlson is pretty much starting from scratch in building a team. The Rough Riders set out the 2020-2021 USHL season because of severe damage done to the ice arena by this past August's derecho, with players going elsewhere via a dispersal draft. The Rough Riders play their first two regular season games in late September in Pittsburgh, as will every USHL team. The home opener is October 16 against the Des Moines Buccaneers. From today's Iowa Today section, Cedar Rapids lifts water boil advisory in the northeast quadrant from Cedar Rapids. The city of Cedar Rapids is lifting the precautionary drinking water advisory for customers in the northeast quadrant. Final testing confirmed water is safe for personal consumption, according to a city news release. Results of bacteria sampling and chlorine monitoring revealed all testing parameters are within normal limits and confirmed that the water is safe for consumption. The precautionary drinking water advisory has been lifted for all affected addresses, including the region bounded by Gulf Street Northeast in the west to Regent Street Northeast in the east, including Summit Schools, and from Regent Street Northeast in the north to 42nd Street Northeast in the south. Also, the region bounded by Council Street Northeast in the west to Elmcrest Country Club in the east, and from 42nd Street Northeast in the north to 34th Street Northeast in the south. Also, the region bounded by Center Point Road Northeast on the west to Eastern Avenue Northeast on the east, including the Elmcrest Country Club and the Collins Aerospace Facility, and from Hollywood Boulevard Northeast in the north to 34th Street Northeast in the south. Lastly, the region bounded by Eastern Avenue Northeast in the west to E Avenue Northeast in the east, and from 38th Street Northeast in the north to 34th Street Northeast in the south, but excluding Kenwood Leadership Academy Magnet School. The city of Cedar Rapids is no longer advising residents within this area to boil their water before using it for cooking or for consumption. And Iowa reports 55 new COVID-19 cases and 3 confirmed deaths. This is a story by Sierra Hoger of the Gazette staff. Iowa reported 55 new COVID-19 cases as of noon Sunday, according to data from the Iowa Department of Public Health and analyzed by the Gazette. Iowa also confirmed 3 new deaths statewide, all over the age of 80. The new numbers raise the state's case total to 372,571 and the death toll from 6,102. The 7-day average for new cases is 79, and the 7-day average for deaths is 4. 7 new cases were reported by Linn County, while no cases were reported in Johnson County. Linn County's total of new cases rose to 21,180. Johnson's total remains at 14,607. Of the new cases reported on Sunday, 10 were for children up to 17 years old, bringing the total for that age group to 44,725. Of the new deaths reported, 2 occurred in May, while 1 took place in June. Cass, Delaware, and Scott counties each reported 1 death. As of 1:30 p.m. Sunday, 43.54% of all Iowans, or 1,373,721 individuals, have been fully vaccinated. A total of 1,310,834 people have received both doses of a 2-dose Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna vaccine, while 117,110 have received the single-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine. In Linn County, 112,270 people have been fully vaccinated. In Johnson County, 83,638 people have been fully vaccinated. Those numbers account for 49.52% of Linn County's population and 55% of Johnson's population. The number of hospitalizations statewide increased by 1 during the 24-hour period, bringing the total of hospitalizations related to COVID-19 to 82. 18 patients are in intensive care compared with 19 the day before, while 8 patients are on ventilators to assist with breathing, up from 7 the day before. The number of outbreaks at long-term care facilities remains at 4, with 31 people, residents, and staff members testing positive for the coronavirus. Also from Iowa City, the Black History Project wins award for historic preservation. A virtual Black History Project featuring buildings that housed Black students at the University of Iowa was one of 11 projects in 7 communities honored with Iowa's highest awards for historic preservation during this year's Preserve Iowa Summit. The annual conference is presented by the State Historic Preservation Office, which is part of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. Honoring Black History in Iowa City won this special project award. The project builds on 2 National Register of Historic Places properties associated with Black history in Iowa, known as the Iowa Federation Home and the Tate Arms. During the early 20th century, both of these buildings housed Black students at the University of Iowa at a time when they were barred from dormitories and had limited housing options because of racial discrimination. Also by Michael Aram of the Gazette staff, an article entitled Motorcycle Ride Shines a Light on Human Trafficking. An annual event taking place later this month aims to raise awareness about human trafficking, which has increased in prevalence during the COVID-19 pandemic in small communities that can be a hotbed for this issue. Chains Interrupted, a Cedar Rapids nonprofit focused on combating human trafficking in eastern Iowa, will host its 3rd annual Freedom Ride on June 26. The motorcycle ride will serve as a fundraiser for Chains Interrupted programming for human trafficking victims, but the main goal is to inform eastern Iowans about the issue and empower community members to help end the practice in their town. I do believe we can make it really hard for traffickers to work in our local environment and be in our communities by knowing what's going on, said Tish Young, event organizer and member of the Chains Interrupted Board of Directors. Registration for the June 26 event starts at 9 a.m. Cost to participate is $15 per rider and $10 per passenger. Motorcyclists will leave the Metro Harley-Davidson in Cedar Rapids, located at 2415 Westdale Drive, Southwest at 10 a.m. Riders will travel through communities surrounding Cedar Rapids, making stops in Troy Mills, Manchester, and Springville, before reaching their final destination in Walford. At each stop, Young said she will give a short speech highlighting Chains Interrupted programming, including its Hotel Motel project that aims to reduce trafficking in those spaces. It's estimated at least 70% of human trafficking takes place in hotels and motels. Young said she also plans to share signs to look for that may indicate human trafficking is taking place in the community, as well as ways parents can protect their children from online grooming. Some experts say human trafficking has increased nationwide during the COVID-19 pandemic, which Young says heightens the need for awareness. The reality is that prevention is key, Young said. We know only a small percentage of victims actually come out of that life. Some studies suggest that less than 5%. So to keep kids from going in, prevention is key. An after party is scheduled at the Freedom Ride's final stop at Wild Hogs Saloon in Walford, which will include food and music from local musician Billy Heller. Riders are expected to reach the location about 3 p.m. Even if they don't participate in the ride itself, Young said anyone is welcome to attend the after party to learn more about Chains Interrupted. Individuals interested in participating can purchase their tickets online ahead of the 2021 Freedom Ride or the nonprofit's website, chainsinterrupted.com/events. For more information about the June 26th event and Chains Interrupted, visit chainsinterrupted.com or contact Young at 319-551-3056. And we have a couple of Eastern Iowa briefs today, the first one coming from Iowa City, entitled Juneteenth Services Schedule is Announced. Iowa City Administrative Offices at City Hall at 410 East Washington Street are currently closed to the public due to the COVID-19 pandemic. In observation of Juneteenth on Saturday, additional closures and changes to schedules have been updated for Friday and Saturday. Juneteenth closures and schedule adjustments include the airport, the office is closed, Jet Air will operate regular hours, and details at jetairinc.com/FBO. Animal Care and Adoption Center is closed Friday but opened Saturday. The Landfill and Recycling Center is closed Friday and open Saturday. The library is open Friday and Saturday. Library Bookmobile, the normal operation is on Friday. The Bookmobile's schedule can be found at icpl.org. The Oakland Cemetery's office is closed. The parking regular enforcement is on Friday and Saturday. Parks and Recreation administrative offices are closed. The Mercer Park Aquatic Center is from 6:15 a.m. to 9 p.m. The Robert A. Lee Recreation Center is from 6:15 to 5 p.m. The City Park Pool facility hours begin at 6:15 a.m. To 9 a.m. Lap swim and water walking. 11:30 to 1:30 p.m. is lap swim and water walking, and from 1:30 to 8 p.m. open swim. The police open for normal operations. Records and administrative offices are closed. The senior center is closed. Recycling and trash. The recycling, garbage, and yard waste will be collected on Friday. In transit, the city buses will operate normally Friday and Saturday. The water office is closed in case of a water emergency. You can call the 24-hour emergency line at 319-356-5166. Normal city operations will resume on June 21. However, some facilities remain closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Visit icgov.org/coronavirus for details. And from Johnson County, the Elder Services announces Elderberry Box Fundraiser. Elder Services Elderberry Box Fundraiser will be held in Iowa City and Coralville and the surrounding area on July 13 to 15. This event will raise money to support Elder Services Meals on Wheels program, which provides a nutritious meal and a daily wellness check to older adults in Johnson County. Orders are being taken at the Elder Services website, horizonsfamily.org/elderservices. Orders of three or more lunches will be delivered for free between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. by a volunteer. Support ensures Elder Services can continue to deliver Meals on Wheels to older adults in Johnson, Cedar, Iowa, and Washington counties. And from the Iowa Today section, a Cedar Rapids man is accused of attempted murder for a shooting in May. A man arrested in Davenport is in the Linn County Jail on suspicion of attempted murder for a Cedar Rapids shooting in May that injured a man at a Blair's Ferry Road Northeast address. Montel C.R. Reed, age 32, was arrested by U.S. Marshals without incident at 4:40 p.m. Friday in the 600 block of West 64th Street in Davenport, according to a Cedar Rapids Police Department news release. Reed was taken to the Linn County Jail on suspicion of attempted murder, going armed with intent, intimidation with a weapon, willful injury causing bodily injury, and a felon in possession of a firearm. The charges stem from an incident on May the 3rd. At 10:20 a.m., Cedar Rapids dispatchers received a report of shots fired from a vehicle at someone walking in the 3700 block of Blair's Ferry Road Northeast, according to a Cedar Rapids police news release. After witnesses described the vehicle, a Hiawatha police officer stopped it in front of AutoZone at 2935 Blair's Ferry Road. Cedar Rapids officers took the driver, Reed, into custody. He was detained pending the investigation and on May 14 was formally charged with attempt to elude and possession of a controlled substance, according to court records. The man struck by gunfire was identified by Cedar Rapids police as Terrell H. Taylor, age 30, who arrived 10 minutes after the shooting at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. After receiving medical treatment, Taylor was discharged into law enforcement custody for an arrest warrant out of Iowa City for second-degree robbery, police said. In January, Taylor had grabbed a purse and a phone from a woman who was injured in the incident, according to a criminal complaint. Cedar Rapids police said in a May 3 news release that based on preliminary information, the shooting appeared to be a targeted incident. According to court documents, Taylor's home address in Cedar Rapids in January was the same home address listed by Reed last week. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, June 14. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.